Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Patricia Jabe Wesley. Patricia Jabe Wesley was born in Liberia and grew up in Monrovia. She is the author of Before the Palm Could Bloom, Poems of Africa, which retells her experiences in the Liberian Civil War. Her awards include the Crab Orchard Open Competition Award in 2002 for her second book, Becoming Ebony, and the Victor E. Ward Foundation Crystal Award for Achievement in the Arts and Contribution to Liberian Literature, received in 2001. Her work has appeared in the Cortland Review, Crab Orchard Review, Midday Moon, and the New Orleans Review. She teaches creative writing at Pennsylvania State University in Altoona. And we're excited to have her. Hi, Patricia, how are you?
I'm fine. Thank you, Jen.
Okay. So you're going to start with some poems from your first book.
I'm excited to be here. My first poem here is the title poem of the second book, Becoming Ebony. This book is dedicated to my mom, the memory of my mom who died in 2000 while I was working on this manuscript. Becoming Ebony is about the whole mixed experience of losing your mother. It was written the week she died while I was here in the United States. And I had to travel to Liberia to bury her after she had survived so many years of the Civil War. She died before the war actually ended. But the poem begins with the experience of having her live with us in Michigan and for 6 months when she really wanted to be in Liberia. So, Becoming Ebony. Did I come all the way here to hide from the sun? Mama will sigh. I can still see Mama standing at the window watching dark clouds, cold winds, yellow leaves, November. Leaves from my neighbor's yard arrived from yesterday's fall. November rations its sunshine here in Michigan. Today, I wish the end of clouds, the end of sky, the end of windows, only curtains bright with daffodils, African violets, hibiscus, wild thorny roses side by side. I want to see the end of neighbors with falling maple leaves, a lazy dog on a leash barking at flying leaves. Those who have no windows do not wait for the sun to come in. Those who have no windows will not hear my neighbor's dog. Here in my living room, the glass window bends the sunlight. A dying fern leans. I am a killer of plants seeking refuge in my living room. I want to see the end of death. An ebony lion on my glass table waits patiently for the sun like Mama. In Byron Center, waiting at the window for the sun to come in, waiting for the war to end. At home. The day Mama died, I waited at the window to see if the sun would come in, to see if my brother would call again. The uncertainty of waiting so a moment will undo itself, to undo that dreaded call, to undo death. How many calls can undo death? An ebony carving knows the uncertainty of skin, the uncertainty of time, the uncertainty of waiting. Brown wood darkening slowly, becoming ebony all the way through. The ebony at home knows how to unfurl white, green branches, how to die slowly, becoming woodwork. A ritual mask for the harvest dance, an ebony lion perhaps on a glass table. That familiar feel of carving knife, the sharp cut, when the carver no longer recalls his purpose. crooked edges polished by the artist's rough hands. And then what was wood becomes marble, a raw tree trunk yielding its life until what was wood becomes iron. The ebony knows how brief color is. When sap licks itself dry into rough threads of wood, they say after the sap is gone, then comes strength. The ebony knows how final color is, how final death is. I have another poem. My second poem I will be reading this evening is a poem I wrote actually upon my arrival here in Pittsburgh, just a few months in. Upon my arrival here in Pennsylvania, I had lived with my family in Michigan for 12 years. And 4 years ago, we moved out here for a job I took at the time at IUP. And it was a shocker. But I took the job because of the hills and the mountains, especially. But I was surprised when I picked up my daughter from the Pittsburgh airport, who was coming home from college and to Pennsylvania for the first time after we moved without her. She was coming to visit us for Christmas 2003, and she was very sad to have moved out of Michigan without realizing that she had moved. And coming through Pittsburgh was the shocker for her. And one of the things I write about is the idea of, and the whole feeling of losing home, of losing everything, and the kind of trauma of losing everything you grew up with, family, friends, relatives, homeland, your property, because of war and the displacement we experience as people coming into the United States civil wars. And this poem is entitled Coming Home for Bise Nyenswa, who is my daughter. Bise runs towards me, arms wide, amidst the crowd at the airport. She's screaming, "Mommy," and everybody stares. Arms around me, my daughter holds me tight, and we almost fall beside her suitcase I have just lifted off the belt. At 19, she is now a woman, tall, slender. Her soft, small arms and fair skin remind me of Mawani, my mother-in-law. In a moment, I'm looking her all over, counting to see if she is not too skinny for a girl her age. Every girl becomes woman when she can come home, knowing how like her mother she is becoming. A woman like all the other women before her. "This is Pittsburgh," I say. "Isn't it beautiful?" We are driving past houses in the distant hills along Pittsburgh's winding freeway, houses that lean and rush past us as we also rush past them. Everything here leans sideways, almost free, as if to fall into the merging rivers down below. My college-age children are coming home to Pennsylvania, where we are surrounded by hills and valleys and cliffs, and the university where my new students speak with an accent they refuse to admit. "So this is home now," Bise says, as if to herself, while I turn into our new driveway in a neighborhood of rolling hills and brick houses overlooking one another. "We are the first black on this property," I say, "but this is going to be home. All these valleys and green hills will be home." "But this is Pennsylvania," Bise says, as doors bang and everyone rushes out to welcome her home after too many months away. We are all trying to find home, I say, as my words become lost in the din of screaming children and my husband lifting Bisse up in the air and swinging her around in circles. All my children are under one roof again, I tell myself. For the first time, all my children are under one roof in our new state. But Michigan is that ghost that stands at the outskirts of your new town where your memory refuses to shut out so many years. And that year when you arrived with nothing and looking to find home among strangers, where the cold, cold winds became a new friend. Your second chance at finding home now becoming memory too. Michigan haunts the holidays, another ghost to carry around among all the other ghosts we are seeking to undo. In Monrovia, families will gather and discuss the many years we have been away from home. Monrovia is the true ghost story of lost peoples in a diaspora. In America, we are the new nomads, the wanderers coming home or looking to make home or running away from home among new people. And one by one, our children who will never know where we really come from are leaving only to come back to decorative lights, Christmas trees, holiday music, and turkey baking in the oven, stuffing and pies. We are becoming new people, I tell myself.
You've just tuned in. You're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Patricia Jabe Wesley. I like the Pittsburgh poem. I want to ask you about something that you said, when you first came to Pennsylvania, that the hills were really important to you. Is that because they're like the landscape of home, of Moravia?
Our hills are not this high. We don't have this many hills. But I think as a poet, the hills and the beauty of the landscape are very inspirational. Monrovia is a hill town and a hill. And one of the shacks that I have is that whenever I'm up a hill, I believe that I'm going to see the ocean. Because in Monrovia, when you are at the top of a cliff, and you're going to come down to the ocean, you know. And our hills are very short. But also because my mother's hometown is on a hill, and I remember how high that hill was. But this is just awesome. When I came for my interview at IUP, I was like, this is beautiful. This is where I want to be. You know, I love the hills. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You talked about the writing of the poem Becoming Ebony, you know, when your mother had died, and I can't imagine the writing of that at that time. Can you talk about the challenges of that and how you wrote that?
Well, surprisingly, I was able to begin writing immediately after I had maybe mourned for a couple of days or maybe the same day. And I was able to turn to poetry. I think one of the reasons is because my mother was one of my biggest fans. I used to read on a radio station in Grand Rapids, Michigan for 5 years straight. I read almost every Saturday until I moved away from Grand Rapids. And then I went for, you know, a few Saturdays on WYCE in Grand Rapids. And mama used to make me tape and the readings and send them to her when she was in the war. And when she came to stay with us, she would sit for long listening to the recordings of previous readings, you know. And so I, for some reason, she was a great inspiration artistically. She was a storyteller. And I was able to turn to writing my feelings down immediately into poetry. And I remember my girlfriend saying, that after you've wept and for a while, you weep and weep, you will come to a point where you will begin to write fine poetry about your mom. It didn't take a long time for me to begin to write. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, I have to wait a long time to write my feeling song.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay, why don't you read a little more?
Yeah, I'm going to read a poem on a more pleasant side. And mostly my poetry comes from the cross-cultural experience of the outsider looking inside with a curious eye. And one of the shocks we experience as newcomers to this country, even though coming to America this time was not my first time, but it was different because this time I came to live, not to go to school. And so the culture of selling and buying, trade and commerce and salespeople, you know, usually shocks me, you know, this culture. So one day I wrote this poem, My New Insurance Plan, and was written at my dining room table right after I took a call from my insurance company. So this poem is entitled My New Insurance Plan. Was written while I was still living in Michigan. It's in Becoming Ebony. My new insurance plan. My insurance company called me today. A great new plan that's just right for me. Thousands of dollars for me when I'm already dead and gone in the grave. While I lie still claps in soil and water beneath stones and cold. My husband or my children or Uncle Sam will claim this benefit for me. But first, I have to die a certain way in a certain month. Let's say December or January, when snow piles up along street corners and sidewalks, when drivers can't get to work in their own cars, when cars go sliding and crashing into walls. I must not die of AIDS or pneumonia or chest pains. Heart attacks will not satisfy this great new plan. I have to crash on the expressway into a wall, a school building, into a house. I must die instantly or they'll never pay. I cannot be hooked up to machines or call in Jack Kevorkian. My insurance plan won't cover such a procedure as Jack's, and the police can't arrive before I swallow my last breath. My bones, all of my bones must be broken, but my eyes must be in place. I cannot give up any body parts before I'm safely in the grave. The cost, the soft bleeding lady convinces, is only $100 a month. A bare $100 from my monthly paycheck while I wait for my car to come sliding on ice, seat belts strapped tightly around me, buckled, of course, me crashing into a welcoming wall.
I love that. That's great. That's great. I think that, you know, as Americans, a lot of people realize the folly of insurance, but you put a new spin on it. And I've never thought about the strangeness of commerce, you know, in that way. Do you have some other poems about that? Or that's okay. You can leap to wherever you're going.
I don't know if I have any other poem about commerce, but let me read a new poem.
Okay.
This is supposed to be the title of my third collection, which is still in manuscript form, and so the publisher hopefully will be published. And this poem was written and as an inspiration from the new historical events taking place in Liberia that will make history, where Liberia, which is very unique for women, you know, women are very powerful in Liberia. Historically, our women have always been strong. And the president of Liberia, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, is the first female president in Africa. And I wrote this poem as a way I was just imagining the experience of having a mother and a grandmother be our president in a country that is so male dominated. And in fact, last week I was invited to an honoring ceremony where she got the Africa Award in New York. I was invited by the Hunger Project to be a part of that occasion. And I was glad to have written this poem. I hope it will stay in my book and not be kicked out by the publisher. And it's called "The River is Rising." I love to write about rivers because Monrovia is a Liberia is a river country. We have six major rivers and the huge ocean. The country, half of the country is on the ocean. And so this poem is entitled "The River is Rising," a song for Liberian women. The river is rising, and this is not a flood. After years of drought, the ground hardened and caked in dry blood, here we are today. River banks are swirling with the incoming tide, coming in from the Atlantic, just beyond the reach of rolling hills and rocks in Monrovia. Finally, here we stand at the banks. Finally, here we are. See how swiftly the tide rushes in to fill the land with salt. The fish and crabs and the huge clams and shrimps, all the river's creatures, are coming in with the tide. This river is rising, but this is not a flood. Do not let your eye wander away from this scene. Yes, all the boons below the Mesorado or the St. Paul or Sino or the Lofa River will be brought up to land, so all the overwhelming questions can once more overwhelm us. But they are bringing in our mother on a high stool, and there she stands waving at those who, in refusing to die, simply refuse to die. The river is rising, but this is not a flood. This is not a song for Ellen alone. This is a song for Mapu and Tene and all the Ellens there are. This is a song for Kema and Musu and Masa. This is for Nyenplu and Nyenwe, for Kou and Glai and Koto, for the one solitary woman of war. This is a song so whining will also dance. A song for that small girl child who came out this morning. They are still seeking a name to call her, a river name, a name from the water and from the fire too. That solitary mother in flight will no longer birth her child by the roadside where shells were her baby's first bed. Let the womb quiver. Let church bells jingle. Let hundreds of drums pound clang clante. Let men bring out old trumpets so the wind will take flight. Let that small pepper bird on the tree branch cry and sing no more the solitary song. Let the Mesorado behind my home, or what was my home, or still is, or maybe, who cares? The river is rising, and this is not a flood. Let no man stand between us and the river again.
Nice, Bill.
I'm going to find two short poems that were not on my list yet. Okay. She asked me, one of my girlfriends here in the studio with me, who is my student, and I want to recognize her. Her name is Carol. She's in my creative writing 213 class, and she wrote out here from Altoona area. Carol wanted to know if I had written a poem to my father, and I said, yes, I have a poem here. I'm going to read this poem to my father and my very, very, very strong-willed father. He thought I was strong-willed. And it's called "A Poem for My Father." I call him Pa. Pa wants another degree from me, a PhD, for sure. Me, his oldest girl child, who was supposed to be a man. As if God won't let Pa into heaven without a family PhD, won't listen to Pa's old arguments about too many children plus too many hungry relatives to feed, too many mats to put down, and all those relatives from Callaway arriving red with dust from 2 days' dusty highway, heavy loads of palm nuts, red palm oil, bags of cassavas, potatoes, edibles, all that rice pounded so white you can see right through each grain. You see, we all know that that rice was pounded just for each trip, relatives coming with dry bush meat, smoked dry like a rack. All those loads of food coming to our door at dawn, the truck's old engine beating lead, gasoline, to help pollute our already polluted earth. The cost of bringing all that foodstuff through 500 miles of rocky, hilly country roads of Grand Jide, Nima, Bong, all this trouble for nothing. Since the loads are for some other relatives who cannot afford to pay the truck driver's fare. But Pa is the town's big book man, pays everyone's debt, marries up everyone's daughter, and when they die, Pa pays the grave digger, the dirge singer, puts the bronze on every casket, the black on every lapa, gin for the morning table, feeds the women on the mat, so the burial is merry and the dead stand proud. Pa buys the kola nuts to chew, meets up the soup, so the mat grows wild. That's why I'm back in school after all these years. In all the homesickness and the snow passes, get that PhD before I die, before they lay me in this earth. If I done, the ground beneath my feet will rock, my feet will slip and slide under my father's, turning over and over in his soggy grave. The whole earth will open its mouth. A house or two may tumble, rock and fall, the ground opening its wide mouth to swallow me up. Okay, I have my last poem. It's entitled, Blessed Are the Sinful, for they shall see God. Blessed Are the Sinful, for they shall see God. You know, once in a while, you know, your religion turns upside down, topsy-turvy. That's what happened to this poem. It's in the new manuscript. Blessed are the sinful, for they shall see God in his plainness without makeup. He has no need to be God to them. They are devils and villains, men, mongers and woman mongers, whores and prostitutes, vampires and robbers, baby killers and smokers of vampires, who shall stand before the throne without flip-flops or sandals, and he shall look at them without blinking or winking or pretending they are even righteous. Blessed are sinners who come into a swinging door singing Amazing Grace. For what use is grace without anyone to grace? And what use is sin without a song? I will be there waiting to see what God has to say to people like us. One bag of iron rocks and sin, plain, simple sin. They shall be as blessed as the ocean waves after twilight, as sinful as the righteous.
That's great. Thank you so much for being here, Patricia. This is poetry of Patricia Jabe Wesley.
Thank you, Jen. Thank you for the invitation. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. Sound engineers are John Belch, Joseph Wilk, and Lauren Wolf. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody, independent public radio, 91.3 WYEP.